if you want to win, if you want to grow, you go where they are, you sell it to them as they're ready to hear it, with the idea that in time you will slowly acclimate them.
You're listening to the Leading Liberty Podcast, where the rising stars of the freedom movement learn from the top minds in pro-liberty marketing, communication, and activism, what's working and not working right now, so you can do your cause the justice it deserves. And now, your host, Jen Gray.
Welcome to Leading Liberty with Chris Spangle. I am your host, Chris Spangle. I am taking over this podcast like the good libertarian authoritarian that I am, and with me is my co-host, Greg Lenz. Greg, how are you?
I'm doing well. Doing well.
Now, Jen Gray is not here this week. No word on if her parents took her to take your kid to work day at the NSA.
Would you claim, Jen?
I don't know. I might take her and have her black boxed.
I was going to say, I contacted Dr. Hoppe and had her physically removed.
Now, you seem to think that Jen is a left libertarian, but Jen is not a left libertarian.
You don't know that.
I mean, she worked at the Goldwater Institute and went to Hillsdale College.
She tried to enroll me in a multi-level marketing crystal scheme. And I think she's on her Costa Rican retirement, siphoning off the profits from all the family members she'd maybe asked to join.
She is a bit of a gypsy.
I know.
I mean, that's where she's been the last 3 weeks.
She's like a step away from making me do an electropsychometer reading and join the Church of Scientology.
So Jen is fine. Jen is good. She will be back, I believe, next week. We will not be here. So if you have hated us, you're welcome. If you loved us, then please listen to us at WeAreLibertarians.com. We have a podcast where we break down current events from an atypical perspective. Think of it as, how would you describe it? Like Meet the Press and Howard Stern had a baby?
Yeah, I would say that's a fair analogy.
All right.
Okay. Yeah, that's a really good comparison. You know, sort of National Review meets Howard Stern.
Right. Man Magazine. You know, yeah. Like we're goofballs. We try not to take ourselves too seriously. But if you follow our Facebook, you think we're idiots. But then if you listen to the podcast, you're pleasantly surprised.
Yeah, I mean, we even changed a mind of a hater. We had a longtime hater who he really didn't care for me. And, you know, he put up with you for diplomatic reasons.
Exactly right.
And yeah. He really didn't about face. Now, after actually listening.
Yeah, he wanted to come back on the show. So now I am the former executive director of the Libertarian Party of Indiana. I'm the former marketing director of the Advocates for Self-Government, or the Quiz People. I work for a nationally syndicated radio show now. I am a former reporter and talk radio show producer. I've done a lot in my 34 years.
Master of the libertarian realm.
Nothing. The unchallenged master of the libertarian realm is quite possibly my greatest achievement.
It really is.
So it's funny because back when I was the executive director of the state party in Indiana, a city councilor in Indianapolis introduced me as the president of all libertarians. And from there, it's just grown into dear leader.
Well, now it went totalitarian. It went from democratically elected to self-appointed totalitarian dictator, and no one resisted.
And isn't that the way that it always goes?
It just means that you have the will of the people.
That's exactly right. So over at We Are Libertarians, we have a joke that I am dear leader because we love to make fun of the idea of a libertarian authoritarian. But we're going to talk about authoritarianism tonight, and we're going to talk about Hitler.
We are. It is an unexpected sort of paradoxical look at what lessons Hitler has for libertarians in order to help, you know, build, unite, and create sustainable momentum for the liberty movement.
Now, you found this book called Selling Hitler by Nicholas O'Shaughnessy.
Yeah.
And you really like it, and it's...
I consider it my political Bible.
Right, and you really liked it, and so when we were having Jen on... We didn't know Jen at all. Like, we barely knew Jen Gray.
I still don't know her.
Right. Does anybody really know Jen? And so we're talking to her about coming on the podcast, and I say, so what do you guys want to talk about? And you start launching into full walls of text.
Well, when someone doesn't take, like, so no one really was moved by anything. And I didn't know Jen, so I didn't know. I knew that most of her traditional content was primarily around tactics and strategies for effective libertarian messaging. And this was an opportunity, since there was a vacuum, to do something I had been mulling around with. And I went ahead and just purged it in a big, long screech, not realizing at all how that might come off to people who are unprepared. I thought maybe she'd listen to the show, or, you know, she'd sort
no.
of... Turned out not at all, and even the entire premise of the show had been misrepresented to me.
Now, don't you start that. But no, it was just a bit shocking, I think, for somebody who didn't know anything about us.
And the walls of text weren't conducive to reading it and understanding why it was relevant.
All she saw was Hitler.
Yeah.
And how good Hitler was. And how much you liked
Hitler. Not good, effective.
How much you liked Hitler.
I respected how he... how he developed some strategies and propaganda that could be applied to libertarianism.
Right.
Effectively.
So she was a bit taken back, I think.
And she still uses it as the example of, like, the worst unprepared situation she's encountered when people apologize to her about not having much prep for her as a guest.
Does she really?
That's the reference she uses. Oh, I'm being shamed every time.
Where does she use this at?
When someone invites her on and then has a busy week and doesn't have much prep for her to come and be a guest, she says, "Oh, don't worry. It's better because this one time."
No, see, I'm not happy with that.
Luckily, she doesn't. You didn't screech like I did, so yeah. You don't have to claim it.
Obviously, we're not advocating genocide or totalitarian regimes or anything unlibertarian like that.
A voluntary Hitler approach.
No. So I think that when you go back and you look at World War II and the lead up to World War II and the leading up of the Third Reich, you see a time in history when so many different tactics for messaging were not only beginning to take shape, but also starting to come about and...
Be academic.
And be academic and be shaped and take hold. And so many of the things that happened in that era were formational for what we're going through now. And so I think that when you talk about messaging, and political messaging especially, it's important to know history so you can or don't repeat it. And so this book, can you talk a little bit about this book called Selling Hitler?
So Selling Hitler is a book that if you look at the cover of it, when you see it, there's nothing else you'll see in the bookstore. Right. And I was walking through the current affairs and political section at Barnes & Noble, and it is Hitler's face, Selling Hitler in meme, basically impact meme font reversed. And then it says Propaganda and the Nazi Brand.
Right.
And so I picked it up and then was shocked because it was different. Most of the political books are really just sort of like chicken soup for the conservative or liberal soul.
Right.
You know, it's sort of stuff that's regurgitated and rehashed and really is just gives you exceptions to point out the flaws of the opposing side's arguments.
It's basically something that was written so the author can have 3,000 copies to sell it. Appearances.
Right. And like the books that don't move are the ones like these where the author doesn't have a brand.
Right.
And so he's an academic, and I started reading it. I was shocked because it was such a commercialized, clearly shock value cover. And then inside right. was this academic work where you had to have an existing knowledge base of the works he was citing.
Wasn't it print? Who was it printed by? Wasn't it like Harvard or Oxford? I mean, he's a British author, and actually we posted about it.
Yeah, Hearst and Company in London.
Yeah, and the guy is a professor at Oxford, mm-hmm. and he ended up liking the status because one of my Facebook friends was friends with him and like said, "Hey, these guys are talking about this and recommending this book." So
it's the kind of book that wouldn't get read much.
Right.
It's very small print.
Yeah.
And it just is ends and ends of footnotes.
Yes. So let's start with you have a framework. From this, you took a framework for messaging that you think can work for libertarians.
Yeah. Well, I think that it can work for any type of political movement because what the book does is rather than like primarily placing the emphasis on the historical events and the context and sort of things that you can't replicate mm-hmm. for the arrival of the Third Reich, it looks at what was the most effective thing they did, sort of their core competence.
And right.
And basically, he makes the premise, which is a rather enormous contribution to the field of study on this, that it was propaganda, and that was the only function of the party.
Mm-hmm.
Everything was about propaganda, and everything else was really just government bureaucracy that followed the basic machinations of any even democratically elected bureaucracy. You know, because even our government operates, the bureaucratic state operates sort of unchecked against the will of the people.
Right.
And so he really separated it out of what did they do well and why were they so effective? And he puts together this theory and breaks it down into three parts on the three core competencies they used to take a predominantly white middle class German country, well educated, and convince them that for there was some sort of meritocratic value or some sort of greater good to genocide.
Mm-hmm.
So the first pillar is primarily looking at an opportunity. And since his training was in the military, in the Austrian army, was basically monitoring propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And so he really believed that why the Germans or why the Weimar Republic lost and had to accept the Treaty of Versailles, paying all the war reparations to rebuild Europe, was because of the effectiveness of the propaganda.
Yeah, and one thing that not a lot of people know is that after he was blinded? I think he was blinded.
Yeah, temporarily.
Temporarily blinded and because of shell shock, and then he was like basically a secret service agent within the
party he ended up taking over.
Right. So
and turning into the Nazi party.
He ended up being a spy on the Nazi party because his job was as a German soldier to go in after the war and spy on German political groups in beer halls and see what they were saying. Well, he ended up being moved or recognizing an opportunity to take over this group of National Socialists. And that's how he ended up getting involved in the party. And it was literally like a party of like 10 people, 13 people when he got involved. So,
and by participating and having the opportunity to watch what moved these people and then recognize that he could hold together sort of antithetical caucuses or coalitions within Germany, in a downtrodden Germany looking for someone to blame.
Right.
Truth be told, he just put together a whole bunch of... it's brilliant, but it's awful. But sure. He really made a just quantum leap in how to build a political movement that restores pride to downtrodden people and effectively brainwashes them by tapping into emotions and then history.
Well, I think there are parallels today, for instance. So sorry to date this episode, but currently we've got a situation where NFL players are kneeling or not kneeling or not standing for the Pledge of Allegiance or the National Anthem or whatever jingoistic thing is going on. And so these NFL players are kneeling, started by Colin Kaepernick, and Donald Trump is now questioning their patriotism. And so you have people exercising their First Amendment rights, and their First Amendment right is being questioned by the very person at the highest level that has sworn to uphold their First Amendment rights. And he is basically saying that, in my opinion, he's basically saying that you're just not patriotic enough. If you were more patriotic, then there wouldn't be so much injustice in your life. You NFL players, code there, need to be more patriotic and love your country more, and then you wouldn't have so many societal ills. And then there's a whole group of people, most of them white baby boomers, on Facebook going, yeah, that's exactly right.
Yeah, it's the town hall caucus.
Right.
You know, red state, they love red state, they love town hall, and if they're really woke, they love conservative treehouse.
Right.
You know, it's that group.
Yeah, so these things are still there. These impulses are still there. Recognizing opportunity within discontent and then assigning the blame to somebody for the originator of your pain.
Right.
It's too complex to say monetary policy is the cause of your pain. It's easier to say, well, these people are the cause of your... It's easier to blame a person than an ideology.
Precisely. And then he also, you know, it's funny. As individuals, one of the things about the Holocaust that's so tough to accept is that as individuals, that would have never been possible on a micro level.
Right.
But humans are able to completely ignore atrocity that they are responsible for. They just don't want to have to accept individual responsibility.
Right.
And so if you give them the right scapegoat and you recognize that, you can, you know, he effectively created an unchallenged political coalition.
Mm-hmm.
And he was really, a libertarian's one of the things we struggle with is there's two frames of thought. Is the Libertarian Party or the Libertarian Movement coalition-based or philosophically-based?
Right.
Do you manufacture libertarians or do you form coalitions and sort of bring people down the well?
Well, essentially, to clarify that, you look at the Democrats and they are coalition-based. After Barack Obama won the presidency, it was, well, he didn't have a Hispanic cabinet a member, so he had to...
Sotomayor.
Sotomayor was a make-good to that coalition.
And she was a twofer.
Right. So, because It is coalition based. You have all kinds of people coming together, putting aside their internal squabbles to work for the good of common causes.
With the expectation to get payoff.
Which is the expansion of government and therefore the bribes that can be given to those coalitions. Now, the Republicans are much more, or were, much more ideology based. And it was a top-down, low government, low taxes.
And really, you know, it got radically changed with communism. The communist threat defined the, you know, modern Republican Party and the rise of neoconservatism. I would be shocked if the Libertarian Party could ever survive as a coalition party.
I'd be surprised if they could ever survive as a philosophy, a philosophical party either, because for 50 years it's been you look at like Sarwark versus Tom Woods. There's a great example of two people who agree on a hell of a lot, but are sitting there arguing over what?
Who they have to hang out with at events.
Right.
Sarwark doesn't want to sit with the right-wing populists because he finds their guns and Bibles, their bitter clingers. He'd rather sit at the coffee shop. And Tom Woods would rather sit with those bitter clingers rather than the neck-bearded, you know,
Cosmotarian.
You know, Jeffrey Tuckertarians.
Yeah, I shouldn't have brought this up because I don't know what it is about Sarwark that pushes your buttons, but I love it.
No, it doesn't. He's an extremely competent chair. He's as competent operationally as anyone that's ever held the position.
But that's a very clear example of how difficult it is for the libertarians to hold a coalition. So
it's purely they don't want to sit at the other table.
Exactly right.
Through association.
Too much ego. Yeah. So if you have to...
And like that's where Hitler was effective, is he said, to hell with that. I'm going to speak to people in the language they're used to hearing it in.
Right.
And I'm going to speak to the unsaid emotions and the untapped emotions they haven't verbalized yet. Mm-hmm. They feel them, but they can't put it into words. They can't describe why they feel the way they feel.
Right.
And that is what a leader that is transformative does. He taps into the emotion that is universally felt, which is what Trump did in activating the white identity. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not that it's the worry of cultural decay so much as it is most of America had no idea that there was a white identity that was dormant.
Sure.
And once it got a little threatened, Trump came around and said, oh, maybe I like this a little bit.
And it's why he, as president, is so quick to go after NFL players, but not, these Charlottesville guys, they're all right. I mean, some of them are good guys.
The alt-left is just as bad.
Right, yeah. Like, he's currying favor with his base, and he's trying to be that transformative And the reason that we, as Americans, react so strongly to it, and I think as libertarians react so strongly to it, is that it does reek of authoritarianism.
It absolutely is.
He reeks of Hitler Kim Jong-un.
Hitler was the first modern political candidate. Hitler over Germany was not a phrase that was about the Führer, the totalitarian. It was he ran the first air-based campaign flying all over into hangars and holding rallies, giving two-hour diatribes that were closer to like speaking in tongues and just in creating fervor. And when you listen to people that, you know, were early on followers in the beer halls, they said, I knew he owned me the second he started speaking. And I would start weeping for no reason because he just spoke, you know, it hit me on an innate level.
Goebbels said that in his diaries. He wrote, leading up to Hitler, how much he didn't like his country, how much he was just stewing in this desire to help, but he didn't know how to deal with it. And then when he heard Hitler speak, he wrote in his diary that he had found a cause to devote himself fully to.
It gave him purpose while he was sort of he spent a lot of time contemplating all these ideas while he was sort of drifting the bohemian lifestyle early on as a youth before getting into the army. And he had always felt like there's this, the phrase is the stab in the back, and that they could have beat, you know, their opponent in World War I if the global financiers hadn't cut off the funds and hadn't brokered a deal. They felt like the rug was pulled out from under him before they got the chance to really, you know, they were still down to fight.
Right.
And so he never forgave them. And so what he did is he thought about a lot about that, and he thought about who was primarily responsible for it, and it was essentially global bankers.
Right.
Early global bankers, the House of Rothschild.
And, right.
You know, what he referred to as urbanites, city dwellers.
A lot of these people say the same things as a lot of those libertarians on the right that, like, I just remember, like, really getting into, because I'm fascinated by the topic of how does a irrational people commit so many atrocities.
Right.
And then when you listen to the language that he was using, I was like, oh man, this kind of sounds a lot like these libertarians over here. Like, and when they're blaming the bankers.
And this is his playbook.
Right.
I believe 100% that Steve Bannon outlined this and they copied it almost to an exact T, but with some modifications for modern society.
Right.
Because Hitler also was the first radio candidate.
Right.
Trump's the first totally TV candidate.
Social media candidate.
Exactly. I mean, direct really. Access. And so, you know, that's the reason Hitler was the first modern political candidate. It's just all new. You know, it used to be you had to get newspaper op-eds and really rely on ground-based, party-based coalitions to get turnout.
Taking new technology and applying it for your means.
Exactly. And that's the defining, that's sort of the ground, or the tectonic shift of new politics is the way Trump has done it, being a direct access political candidate, which mirrored much of this similar change for Hitler when he rose. And so what Hitler was really good at, though, is he united a Bavarian identity the way in the United States Trump did a white identity.
Hmm.
So he did that with the author's premise is that you use a creation myth that refers to the pride of the Teutonic pride, that they see themselves as one against an enemy in a greater superior, basically racial superiority and historical superiority. And they even tap into old vengeances going all the way back to the very early years of the Teutonic Knights.
Right.
And so by doing that, it allowed them to talk to antithetical political coalitions.
Sure.
Just like with Trump, by tapping into white people, all of a sudden police unions loved him.
Right.
All of a sudden blue collar Democrats became hardcore Trump Republicans. And so it totally realigned the electoral map in the United States, much the way Hitler did. The only difference being Hitler didn't have a CNN. And so he relied upon his best people around him that were already familiar with these coalitions. So you send the Tea Party person to speak to the Tea Party. You send the economic conservatives to speak to the economic conservatives. And you tell them this new sort of activation by tapping into history and a creation myth, but then also in the language they're ready to hear it from. And that's where libertarians struggle.
Mm-hmm.
We demand you read Rothbard before we're even going to talk to you about what you care about.
Right.
And that's where we really, I think the whole movement really needs to get better at. It doesn't matter whether Sarbach or Tom Woods are right, whether Jeffrey Tucker or Tom Woods or Lou Rockwell are right. If you want to win, if you want to grow, you go where they are, you sell it to them as they're ready to hear it, with the idea that in time you will slowly acclimate them.
Well, I think so. If you look at these three steps, recognizing opportunity within discontent, seizing an imperfect opportunity to shape a movement.
Mm-hmm. And then accepting imperfection.
And then the shaping process in number three.
Mm-hmm.
Libertarians are very familiar with why they are miserable.
Federal Reserve. Fractional reserve banking.
Not just that. I think every libertarian has their own pet project. I mean, for me, I'm very anti-war. I'm very anti-police state. I don't think that is the case for every libertarian. They're pro pot, or they're anti drug war, or they're anti this, anti that. You know, there's a lot of different reasons that people get attracted to the libertarian movement, and they take these various offshoots of government overreach, and we never really fit that into a cohesive. We fit that into a cohesive bitch session, but we never really fit that into a cohesive solution. And here's how we can fix this problem.
And the truth is, you just should ignore it entirely, because whoever's right it's irrelevant.
Right.
It's about effectiveness only.
Explain that.
Because everyone, the radical caucus, the Tom Woods people, the right libertarians, and then the more, the ISFL libertarians,
the cosmotarians, like the Reason people.
Exactly. You know, right. the more Matt Welch types, who are they can't stand the lasting vestiges of like right-wing popularism,
right.
and Ron Paul newsletters. And so rather than bickering about which style is right going forward, accept it all. Don't sit next to it. You know, take a voluntary approach, but still go and sit at, still go and participate. And then just let that coalition speak to the people they can get, and let them do it in the most effective way possible. And don't try to control how they do it and worry about you having to claim them. And that's what And but we haven't, the Liberty Movement hasn't found the one theme that transcends all those the way that Hitler was able to with economic discontent.
Well, so essentially, once you identify that discontent, then find strategic allies to go within each movement to go and speak to people
In the way they're used to hearing it.
But how do you know what is the right discontent to hit on?
I mean, for me, in my opinion, in like the Liberty Movement as mm-hmm. a whole, we're so well situated. Americans love to talk about their founding fathers and this limited government. The first time, you know, we threw off our colonial masters and, you know, created the dream of justice, and it's a small government history.
Well, to me, and I'm glad we're on the same page, because I was going to say that for the creation myth for libertarians, it is that we as libertarians are the natural heirs to the founding father generation, and with new technologies, we have the ability to reshape society in the way and that our founding fathers imagined.
And they explicitly believe the responsibility.
Right.
You know, when a series of injustices are too much to take, you have the, you know, not just the right, but the responsibility to put on new ones.
Exactly right.
And so that's why I'm everyone hates me, but I love the idea of using nationalism to sell libertarianism on a grand scale. Not at the Libertarian Convention, but in a campaign.
So here's where I have to go back at you on that, because nationalism, so you go back to the Trump example. Trump is using nationalism and patriotism.
Ethno-nationalism.
But Trump, yes, but Trump is using the flag and the anthem specifically to change the conversation from a very legitimate concern from a half-white, half-black American saying that even though I am half in your camp, I am still half in the other camp, and I could be killed at a police stop. And what Trump is saying, I don't care about that. You're not a patriot. Let's debate that.
Right.
And so he's using nationalism to stir up furor into...
Well played.
Into, I know, the audience did not see that coming.
And frankly, I'm offended.
And so nationalism, if you look at the run-up to the Iraq War, nationalism was used to move us into a war, questioning someone's patriotism. So nationalism is often used for anti-liberty purposes.
And that's why it's time we take it back.
Okay.
To me, it's the most effective tool you can have is tapping into the identity, the cultural tribal identity, and we get the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
The nostalgic parts... The restoration, returning to, you know, what we like. There's the baby boomer on Social Security and Medicare talking about, some, you know, the Tea Party rally.
Right. So what you're saying basically is, what is patriotic about John McCain? What is patriotic about Nancy
Nothing.
Pelosi? What is patriotic about Mitch McConnell? Rand Paul is the patriot.
Yes. Only.
Rand Paul is the person standing up there saying, I'm going to fix healthcare, and I'm not going to add $1 trillion to our debt to do it.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. You know, Gary Johnson's the only patriot. He's endorsed by the ACLU, an organization that exists specifically to protect the Bill of Rights.
Right.
That's the only patriot I see. You know, that kind of verbiage.
He's tapping into the human struggle for liberty is so intense. And if you study history, it is just one giant fight between, you know, the totalitarian overlords and human liberty. And the torch is carried by modern libertarians. If you look at...
They're the only ones doing it.
If you look at North Korea, the people who are fighting for their freedom right now are libertarians trying to throw off the despotic regime of people who try to steal every ounce of their natural liberty. And we are going to fight for a free North Korea by using economics to solve that problem. We are going to instill the values of freedom in that country, not through bombs, but by trading with them economically.
Hell,
and that's how we will export freedom.
We could go put air, you know, naval carriers right around the, you know, surround it, and then offer, you know, guarded boats for anyone wants to defect.
But that,
you know, that would to, be,
is that,
you know,
but what I just said, is that an example
perfect.
Of libertarian
You're nailing
message?
It. Right. And like, that's what I've felt for so long, because there aren't a whole lot of effective tools, really, in politics.
Right.
And from all I've seen, the libertarian movement cares so much more about their version being the correct version and the one followed. The second that it isn't or it's challenged, they break rank.
Right.
Which is why you have to have some coalition elements to it and transactional elements to it. But it has to be around some sort of general theme that people are proud of.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I care about ethno-nationalism or I think that's the best libertarianism. It works.
Sure.
And I don't give a crap about anything else, because all I care about is getting to the destination.
Which is getting...
And I'll use any tool I have to get there.
Which is getting elected. Which is winning your cause.
Yep.
And which is winning your race. Which is winning whatever your ballot initiative.
And if you want to be an agorist and you want to use, you know, counter economics, that's awesome. Just don't shame people that don't, that are taking a different strategy to get there. Everybody in the same camp, don't undermine each other. Don't go around and demand that it be this blend of libertarianism. Be thankful they can go speak to people that when you go talk about Austrian economics, their eyes glaze over and think you're an idiot.
Right. I think the other part of it is that technique of saying, this is how we can use patriotism to free other countries. This is how we can support the patriotic Rand Paul over the anti-American Lindsey Graham.
Yep, exactly.
For instance, is... We as libertarians spend so much time as reactionaries fighting against, I am a patriot, this is what I believe, blah, blah, blah. Like, and when you're explaining in politics, you're losing. And you have to be able to consistently message, stay on message, and that message always has to be positive and fighting against, you know. Don't ever go back and explain why you are patriotic.
It doesn't matter. Yeah, patriotism is whatever you define it as.
Right.
There is no council that decides.
Right. Turn it around back on them and say, how do you justify $20 trillion in debt being patriotic?
Which is exactly what Hitler did with National Socialism.
Right.
You know, he all of a sudden decoupled socialism from global, you know, workers of the world unite, which is how it had, you know, an international approach to a state-based approach. Where it's a common cause where you cared about your countrymen, you're all ships working towards the same, everyone's taken care of, and it created this sense of, we're all in this together, and I like where we're going, and it drove the Bolshevik, some of the lasting elements of the Bolshevik Revolution and like the Trotskyites crazy because it was, this isn't how it was supposed to work, you know, and exactly. That's exactly what happens in libertarianism, is it? We can't go for the alt-right, you know, the right-wing populace because everybody thinks they're racist. And well, they care so much about how they're perceived.
Right.
They don't give it outranks how much, if any kind of libertarian improvements happen.
Sure. They care so much about being politically right that they don't recognize how many people... It's not about the Richard Spencers of the world. Those are the people you're not trying to reach. That's not what you're saying.
No.
What you're saying is...
I'll take them if they'll come down the well.
Is to get that certain lane of your Facebook fandom, listener, that posts the veiled pro-Trump...
That's what I do.
Why can't we... Not saying being pro-Trump, but I'm saying, like, I saw somebody that we went to high school with today. She is a 27-year-old woman. She is a mother. She's a wife. And she was just, you know, railing against all of these NFL players and blah, blah, blah. There's no sense in immediately jumping on that person's status and saying, nationalism is a cancer. It's give an answer that will fulfill that need in a way that they are persuaded by, not telling them why they're wrong. And that's a very tough thing. That's a very tough needle to thread.
You have to be able to suspend your own ego.
Yes. And I think that's the biggest part that libertarians struggle with, because we, as we talked about in the last two episodes, we don't often think about the message and how it's being received. We are thinking about the message and how it's being presented.
It's a martyrdom movement.
As opposed to... realizing that the listener is very selfish and they only care what they're getting out of it. And if they're getting nothing out of it because you are just mental or you're just masturbating words all over the place, talking about how, you know, this,
I've got an audience, they're captive and I'm going to abuse it.
I know that this person showed a mild interest in my economic policy roughly 10 minutes ago, but I'm just going to keep going. Even though they've clearly gazed out and they're looking on their phone, I'm going to keep talking about, praxeology and the history of the Austrian economic movement. They don't care. They want to know, how are you going to solve their problems?
Why? And they want to know you care first.
Right.
Because no one gives a crap what you're selling until they know that you care. Right. And you understand.
Because you hate politicians because they care about themselves and their cronies and not you.
Right. They go around looking for mobs to lead.
Why would you replicate that?
Exactly. And so you end up becoming the person you hate, and that's what undermines it out of the get-go.
Right.
And so that was what he was so good at, is he said, you know what? I don't care at all what your coalition thinks is the right way to sell National Socialism.
Mm-hmm.
We are selling it around this one general theme of restoring a downtrodden once great country against the rest of the world. It's us versus them. And it created an all ships on hand, which is what it has to be for the libertarian movement. The collectivists versus the individualists.
Right.
Because at every step of our lives, it is that same war in every element.
Yep.
And that's why the United States, like, that's why libertarianism is actually strong here, comparatively.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was founded as a, you know, a small government revolution.
Yep. So the you have written here the Holy Trinity of propaganda. Number one is the creation mythology.
That's the most important thing, because that's what allows you to have the theme that speaks among the antithetical coalitions that you're going to need to achieve anything of, you know, real substance. You know, that's why Rand Paul is sort of, he's more relevant than his father, but he's still flirting with martyrdom like his dad did, because he just doesn't have a big enough coalition to let him be the Lindsey Graham or the John McCain, the philosophical and legislative leader of the party.
He's standing alone on principle.
And thinks that's like, worthy.
Ted Cruz is a great example of somebody who stands alone on principle, and people admire that, but he doesn't get anything done.
That's great. Yeah, that's what I mean. Like, that's right. Why I think it's a martyrdom movement for the most part.
Right.
And that's, and you don't want to abandon principle. But at the end of the day, you have to quit waiting for the world to change to the way you need it to accomplish what you want.
Yeah,
if that's your strategy, it'll never happen.
So number two is rhetoric, stoking emotions.
It's right. So you tap into, rather than talking about economic policies, you talk about whatever pain they're feeling, and then you sort of nurture it and cultivate it by, you know, giving them the scapegoat, which for Hitler was global financiers and urbanites, i.e. the Jewish people.
Mm-hmm.
They were what he considered to be, they had struck the, you know, Teutonic heritage in the back. And that's why he felt that it was fine to treat them as he did.
Right. Well, it was an ignorance on the German people's part, because so many people were rural and agrarian, and it was a largely Jewish population in the urban centers. And so they had never met a Jewish person.
Mm-mm.
You know, so you could blame them.
An abstraction.
Right. And that's kind of what the establishment has become. Nobody knows a person in the establishment.
Jeb Bush.
Right. They have those avatars like a George Bush, but they don't really know a person who is in the establishment.
Right.
You know, and if you knew our friend Abdul, who is in the local establishment, you'd like Abdul a lot.
Oh, yeah, he's a totally practical, great guy.
Yeah, and so we have turned politicians into these avatars, and instead of, you know, trying to be politicians and turn ourselves into politicians.
And I'm saying we just need to find the right avatar to project a scapegoat to the coalitions we're trying to sell.
Right. Well, the establishment,
we need someone to blame.
The establishment has worked well.
It has. And the globalists and this conspiracy, like, that's right. Why Trump was effective.
Right.
That's why Hitler was effective. It was the perfect person to blame for their lot in life and the terrible economic policies and the printing, the mass inflation, no opportunity, and having to pay all the debt burdens of the rest of Europe while they suffered.
Now, Trump is a great scapegoat for the left now. You know, he is the cause of all the left's ills in society.
Exactly. He's everything wrong. He is literally Hitler, which is kind of fitting.
You have the common bond.
You have the common bond. Then you give them who's to blame.
Right. And
then who's to blame builds the emotions. Because then all of a sudden you say, they're to blame and we don't have to take it anymore. I just need you to vote for me on election day and trust me and I will make us great again. Or I will restore Germany and we will become the premier race.
Right. So here's the problem for libertarians is they don't think they're emotional. And they're so in their own head about what is right and what ought to be the way to do these things that they lose sight that it is emotional. And that, you know, we have something, a series on We Are Libertarians called The Cost, where I interview people affected by government policy. It doesn't matter how many statistics I throw at you about domestic violence and the harm that the CPS and the system does to women of domestic violence. That's none of that works. But none. If I can sit you down and you listen to a 3-hour podcast with someone who has been a victim of domestic violence, by the end of it, you are ready to storm the Indianapolis City County Council building because 100 people did nothing to help this person.
It's our version of a Willie Horton ad.
Right.
You know, where the stats may not even remotely be on your side, but you find the right human interest story and
yep.
You're gold.
Because we are trying to show these government policies actually affect people. This is what's happening because we're doing an emotional appeal. it's not manipulation. It's trying to effectively show you how these people actually feel, because we are in a medium with podcasting where we have the extensive amount of time to have someone tell their full story. And very few people get the chance to tell their full story. And when they do, it's really powerful. And
that's why Oprah was so big.
Storytelling is the foundation of human psychology. The storytelling is as important to the human brain as water and food. Storytelling is the way that we transmit information. It's the external hard drive of the human brain, where we pass things from one generation to another through story. And so the brain doesn't work in facts and figures. You don't know all the different calculations of Isaac Newton, quote unquote, inventing gravity, discovering gravity, but you know the story of how he figured it out. It's the apple hitting the head. Oh, well, that makes sense. And you quickly grasp the concept, because your brain is...
It learns by metaphor.
Yes, your brain is trying to preserve calories and survive, and so the harder the brain works for your listener, the quicker they're going to tune you out. They've got to have it quick. And so symbolism is the third in the holy trinity of propaganda, because it quickly distills down that story into a simple symbol. Just like the American flag, these people fought and died for your bravery. Well,
the Star-Spangled Banner, our founding documents printed right on everything, you know, it is... What it really does is it reinforces what you need them to accept.
Right.
And then... If they ever have doubt, it is such a deterrent to any type of doubt.
Right.
Truth be told, if they hadn't been genocidal, they would have just taken over everything.
Yep.
Because they were so sure they were marching towards the next great achievement in human history, mm-hmm. that they were willing to tolerate a certain level of atrocity until they just couldn't deny it anymore.
Right.
They just couldn't handle it as a reflection of who they were as people.
So here's a modern example. If you look at the flag, if you look at the NFL versus the Trump debate, okay, you have Trump using the symbol of the flag and all that stands for his people, and evoking those emotions, and, you know, the creation myth of everybody's grandfather was in World War II and he fought, and my grandfather and your grandfather, and we have this connection, and this is the story that this guy, by kneeling, is just trampling on the flag.
He's pro-Nazi. That's what he's saying. Right. He was against the Normandy invasion. It was wrong, and he wanted the Holocaust to happen.
Exactly right. Whereas Colin Kaepernick is saying nothing, and the other side is saying, we just stand against hatred and bigotry. Well, then you're putting them on the defensive by saying, I'm not a bigot. I'm not hating. I'm standing up for my country. Instead of saying, no, we're standing up for the First Amendment right. We are kneeling because the country... Because we believe in the flag too. I am not sitting, I am kneeling in front of the flag because I want to make a political statement that is guaranteed by the First Amendment, that is part of that symbolism of that flag. And the American flag to me means that it was a promise to my ancestors as a black man in America that justice will be done, and that you, Mr. President, have sworn an oath on a Bible in front of that flag to adjudicate when my people are violently gunned down in the streets.
A series of aggressions.
And so if you believe in that flag, Mr. President, then you will fulfill your First Amendment duties and help fight with me to stop this atrocity from happening all over America. And you see how much more effective that is than... I stand against racism and bigotry.
If we just eliminate the justice system, then they would never be able to do it anyway.
Right. I am taking you on that journey, telling you as... Now, I am a white man, but I'm saying that if I were in his shoes, I would say...
That's how you do it.
As a black man, this country has made me promises. And it is your job, Mr. President, to keep those promises and to continue to move society forward to a more equitable society. Now, what are you going to do to help me?
Yep.
And you end with that call to action and join with me to solve this problem. And that's where I would say that...
That's what we don't do is... And I'm a big proponent... Like, so the things that everyone hates, I love. So I love false binaries.
Right.
You just got to use them where it's beneficial to your side.
Right.
You know, that's why as a libertarian, you know, for me, like with the drug war, it's like, they're criminals. But if I'm talking to like a Tea Party rally,
right,
they're a bunch of criminals, but damn, I'm tired of paying for it, aren't you?
Mm-hmm.
You sell it to them in terms that they'll accept.
Yeah.
You know, you go, you meet them in a way they will accept it, rather than making sure they accept your premise and demand they accept your premise because they arrive at the conclusion the right way.
Right.
I don't care about right and wrong. I know that's horrible, like, but politics isn't about right and wrong. It's about what wins and what doesn't.
Right. So like the drug war, there's two very, there's a clear example. Okay, the New York Times this past Sunday had an article about Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
And Portugal completely changed their system and started treating it like a mental illness as opposed to a war. And they have seen astronomical improvements in drug use in that country and astronomical drop in AIDS. And it's just been a terrific...
revolution, really.
It's been a revolution for that country. And yes, you got facts and figures in that New York Times article, but you also heard from Marco or Mario or whoever the guy was who told his story and the journey that he went through as a Portugal man who, you know, compared how much this and that worked and how this in America didn't work this way and here I've gotten help and blah, blah, blah. You know, he told a story. And so often libertarians will say, well, see, listen, AIDS dropped by 500% in Portugal from 2004 to 2017, never realizing that the person listening to them does not give a crap. They don't care what you're saying.
They're immediately talking about how you probably heard that from CNN.
Right. What they care about is that their cousin or their friend is on opioids and they're going to die, and how are you going to help fix it?
Mm-hmm.
And the way that you tap into that is, listen, I have a podcast. I have a very successful podcast. I'm speaking to you, Greg, as a constituent. And, I had a co-host named James. And James was a very important friend. He contributed a lot to my podcast. But James loved to get crunk on purple. And he would go out every weekend and do so much dank kush and drink so much purple that his life spiraled out of control. Now, this is all made up, but James really does do purple a lot, which is a lot of cough syrup. And James was just out on the streets, and James ended up in a bad place, and James ended up passing away. And so I wake up every day dedicating my life to James's memory. And I know that if I could go back in time, what I would do is I would go to this person and have this solution, and I would have this congressman work on this bill, and these are the steps that I would use to eliminate opioid addiction. You see how in stats and figures you're not really reaching that person, but when I start talking about my friend James and then lead you into the stats and figures and solutions, you're much more invested in me winning, and as a result, you winning, because through the telling of that story, I am tapping into the emotions that I felt around my friend James, and they as a human being are empathizing with every one of those same emotions.
They understand that you care because you're suffering the same pain.
Exactly right. And then they go, how can we fix this? Let's work together.
And that's where I would say, I don't even know that I'd tell them a similar story. I would just ask them, well, how would you handle it? What do you want to do to help?
Sure.
If you vote for me on Election Day, I will have you in. And when we undertake this legislative agenda,
mm-hmm.
I will give you prime input so that we can make sure your brother isn't harmed by the system anymore.
Right.
And you turn it on him. And that's sort of what Hitler did.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why he was effective, is that it didn't matter what he believed. The man was a mirror. Whatever he needed you to believe, he just listened and then became a advocate for that. Raving, proud, ranting advocate that you had, a savior you'd never knew existed. He became whatever you needed him to be.
Right. Now, you're tiptoeing away from philosophy there, so that's why I don't think a lot of libertarians will accept what you're saying.
And that's why they hate me. Because I don't care. I'm amoral. Like, I'm amoral on politics and messaging.
Right.
I just don't give a crap because I'm tired of losing.
Right. Yeah, you are very firm in your libertarian beliefs, but when it comes to actually winning elections...
I can separate the two. My ego. It doesn't matter to me that my brand of libertarianism wins.
Right.
It doesn't matter to me that they can relate to me.
Mm-hmm.
I just want their vote, and that's it. And it's transactional, and I want to make sure that then I create an environment that is reinforced through symbolism, that makes them proud, that makes them accept what I tell them after I've demonstrated I care by listening to them and only them and not telling them what I think.
Right.
That in time... I am such a trusted confidant. I could walk out, to quote the president, I could walk out into Madison Avenue and shoot somebody.
Right.
You know, that's the kind of loyalty you're looking for.
Right.
And people hate this because it can be so easily distorted for terrible atrocity.
Right.
Which we've already seen. But libertarianism, the way we're doing it, isn't working.
Yes.
The only reason it's rising is because the surveillance state and so many the bureaucratic state and globalism is so intertwined. We've reached a point where that is the only glimmer of resistance. I mean, Julian Assange said it best, that the Liberty Caucus is the only hope he has for effecting political change against the deep state.
I guess the way to put it is they're doing everything right, and we're doing absolutely nothing to help libertarianism grow.
Even though we think we are.
Right.
We just have not been able to swallow our own pride.
Mm-hmm.
And because we want the world to be the right way.
Right.
Rather than accepting it as it is and using it, even though we have a strategic advantage in the founding of the country to tap into, that will activate an American national identity that most tend to believe is a small government mentality. It's not libertarian, mm-hmm. but it's way the hell smaller government than basically any other structure that's been set up.
Sure.
I mean, parliamentary, constitutional republic-wise, it is the gold standard.
Right.
And so that is something that's to our advantage, and yet if I were to say that, I would be attacked for accepting government by people who I share the exact same belief system with.
It is,
and trying to be a national a part of the problem as a nationalist scumbag.
Isn't it amazing how many people run for political offices, Libertarian Party people, but they're anarcho-capitalists who don't believe in any government at all, and then the second you are running under a constitutional Republican system and then try to advocate for the constitutional Republic, you're a traitor to the cause.
Bill Weld Jr.
It's so weird to me.
I know. It's very much that's the problem is, in my opinion, the problem with the Libertarian Party is that they basically have been so irrelevant for so long, they think anyone's paying attention. They could literally come out and endorse Hitler, and it would have no effect on the vote totals.
Right.
I mean, honestly, that if you want proof, Donald Trump, you lost to Donald Trump by 58.5 million, and you lost to the loser by 61.5.
Right, and that was Hillary Clinton.
Crooked Hillary and Donald.
Right.
And so the fact that you still care what people think, when he's going around talking about that you can grab people by the genitals and they want you to because you're a big star.
And they let you do it.
And you're deathly afraid of Bill Weld thinking anyone cares that he was a Republican.
Right.
You're moronic.
Yeah. It's so true.
You know, like the echo chamber just totally dissociates you from anything relevant. That's why I avoid any kind of group that is libertarian in name, except ours, because I am so baffled that anyone thinks anyone cares that that's real life.
It is really people virtue signaling for other libertarians to show off their purity and social proof. I mean, it's really destructive to the cause to bash other people for their activism.
They're on your side.
Right.
It's a multi-front war.
Right.
If they're better in the infantry than the cavalry, go let them get in the trenches.
So we gotta
don't disavow them and say, well, that's not my army. That's not my Bill Weld, infantry.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the thing. If it's ever going to work, and that's why I said these are lessons for libertarians, oddly, the man who called himself the Führer and created a totalitarian dictatorship suspended his ego long enough to get to what he needed.
Right.
And that's the true lesson.
For 15 years, 20 years to finally get there.
I mean, he just took over France and they were throwing baguettes and welcoming him with parades. You know, like he was a student of Nietzsche, and that he was the Übermensch, and that there was no morality, just great achievements. And that's what he, you know, sort of viewed himself as. But
right.
we're bound by principle. So we can be willing to go down these rabbit holes and dabble with things that make us uncomfortable. Because at the end of the day, there's no, even though you're dear leader, a totalitarian, unchallenged master of the libertarian realm, I know you're not going to start a left libertarian genocide.
Right.
You know, there's no threat. You achieve a totalitarian dictatorship, you know, a Spangle Reich, there is absolutely no threat of anything being worse.
I don't know. I think we'd be better off without baby boomers, to be honest with you.
Well, prima nocta.
Right.
Luckily, baby boomers with aging, it handles itself.
Yes.
They self-deport.
All right. Final thoughts as we start to wrap up this episode.
Yeah, and I know this is going to be just so... You're either going to just love it and think, I need to spend some time, you know, putting this into working. Or this is so many libertarians, this is such everything they hate, they will never allow it to be how they do it.
Yeah.
You know, they very much believe that it's a church and they are the way, the path, the light, and anyone who doesn't get baptized in that parish isn't going to Liberty Heaven.
Yeah.
You know, and so that's fine, because I don't care. You're going to convince people the way that you know how better than I ever will. Mm-hmm. And I'll never disavow you. You're not my enemy. Not yet. When we have to debate minarchism, anarchism, maybe we'll be enemies and we'll be on opposing sides. But for now, we're not even close.
Right.
So let's just go ahead and if you hate me, ignore me. But don't go around telling people I'm not a libertarian.
Right.
Otherwise, you just create a vengeance and it becomes about imparting my view of libertarianism over you and then publicly shaping you on how you're constantly wrong.
And he's better at memes than you.
I'm the unchallenged master of the libertarian meme realm.
Yeah, I think that I would add to this for my final thought. Is there anything else that you wanted to say?
No, I'd say, you know, we need to have a serious conversation with the movement as a whole about our found. We need to define our mythology, our creation myth. We need to change our rhetoric and take our ego out of it,
mm-hmm.
and only seek to speak to what other people are ailing, because that's why Ron Paul's Iowa support didn't go to Rand and it went to Trump, because the number one reason in exit polling was the outsider had nothing to do with libertarianism.
Right.
Which is fine, though, because that means Rand could have kept him if he had ranted and railed about the globalists.
Yeah.
Rather than trying to be, you know, a kind of... you know, compassionate conservative. And so that's what libertarians have to remember, is that use what works and stop worrying about it. If you can't, just do what you do, and I'll leave you alone as long as you leave me alone.
I would say that libertarians need to embrace the idea that politics is show business. And we do this very poorly because we are so very careful, because we have been lied and hurt. We've been hurt by the other political parties, and so we want to be better as Libertarian Party people, or libertarians who are outside of politics, that we're going to do things differently. And so we are very strict about how and what we say. And you have to realize that there is an art to politics, and that there is a showbiz element to politics.
Especially in the modern world, it's all that.
Exactly right. And so you have to be comfortable with building that character, building that avatar, and then projecting that character and performing as that avatar for people. Do I think that Donald Trump is the person that he's portraying on Twitter? Absolutely. There is absolutely part of Donald Trump that is that person. But that is not all of Donald Trump's identity. There is much to the man that I'm sure, if you were to meet him, he's very warm. He's probably very charitable. He's very loving to his family. Like, his kids seem great. Like,
they really are impressive kids. I mean, Ivanka's impressive.
So he can't be all that bad, but he plays a character to get a desired effect. And so you have to begin with the end in mind and start putting that character together and then working your way back and projecting that.
You reverse engineer what your result.
Exactly right.
And we can't afford conditions on how we do it.
Right.
We don't, I only want to win if it's on, you know, voluntary interaction.
Yes.
And until there are private courts, I want no part of the political process. Okay. You know, that's why I call them Liberty LARPers and, you know, Peter Pan and the Lost Liberty Boys, you know, waiting for this never land that doesn't arrive.
Right.
You know, it's just head in the sand, you know, utopianism.
So it is really about, and I'm not saying that you lie. Never let the facts get in the way of a good story is what I'm saying. But you still have to be authentic. You still have to project real parts of your personality. You just have to make sure that you are very careful about your image and what you're putting out there.
See, like, I don't even think you have to be, because the attention spans aren't long enough in our society. Right. So narcissistic. Everybody's so busy thinking about what everyone else is thinking about them, they don't have the memory committed to even remember that you used to be the Reform Party candidate, or that you know, were on The Apprentice, or that, yep, you know, any of the Donald Trump. The world is so narcissistic, you don't have to worry about how you're perceived. You get a redo because no one paid attention last time.
Yep.
Unless you moved the needle.
All right. Thanks so much for joining us here on this episode of Leading Liberty with Jen Gray. We are so thankful to Jen for letting us host, and surprised when Jen said go ahead and do the episode on Hitler. I was surprised.
Yeah, but I mean, it's definitely clickbait podcast title, if you will, you know. But I think that you know, it isn't some. We're not saying that it needs to be top-down, centrally planned freedom.
Right.
We're saying these are some effective techniques, and let's talk about ways to implement them.
Exactly. So thanks for joining us here on this episode of Leading Liberty. Make sure that you check us out on WeAreLibertarians.com. And we are so glad that Jen will be your next host. We loved getting to do this, but we know that this is her home. And she is tired of us sitting in her living room. So we will see you on WeAreLibertarians.com. And thanks for listening.
Hey, did you like this episode? Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review. Learn more about how to market pro-liberty causes and campaigns over at jengray.com. And I'll see you on the inside.